You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Jeff Swiston.
Because I think too often in branding and marketing now, and certainly in, you know, online advertising where it's 5 seconds, quick hits, we're almost afraid at talking and telling a brand's complexity. And it's in the complexity that the story actually exists.
Jeff is a consulting CMO working with leading brands and brands that want to lead. Prior, Jeff was Chief Communications Officer at DDB Worldwide and Chief Marketing Officer at Interbrand. A prolific speaker and writer, Jeff has appeared at over 100 conferences in over 25 countries. He is the author of The Brand Glossary, The Brand Marketer's Report, Best Global Brands, Best Canadian Brands, and Best Chinese Brands, as well as the new book, Why Marketing Works. Over 100 publications have featured Jeff, including The Wall Street Journal, Advertising Age, Fast Company, Rolling Stone, and Managing Intellectual Property. He's a marketing expert for CNBC, USA Today, Toronto Star, and BNN. Jeff, welcome to On Brand.
Hey, thank you so much, Nick. I'm really looking forward to this.
So I have to say, as a follower of all things Interbrand and someone that references Interbrand reports frequently, you note many of those studies that are the best global brands, the best Canadian brands, the best Chinese brands. Among all of these, is there a common denominator for the best brands?
Well, you know, there's a lot of competing studies out there, which is interesting now. When I was working with Interbrand and we took what had been a regional study globally and began working with Business Week and giving it high profile, and it was neat to see that that best global brand study became the third most sought after ranking after, I think, Great Places to Work and the Fortune 500 itself. So it really, really caught on. But, you know, it also then sparked a lot of imitators. And there's actually a site, and I'll blank on the URL right now, but it's a ranking of global brand rankings. So I think there, when I was last there was like 200 different brand rankings now in the world. What really differentiated, I think still differentiates, the Interbrand report is that it's based on an economic model of brand valuation. And, you know, a lot of the studies out there are highly subjective. So, you know, they'll talk about love marks type thing. And yet, so you have to question the methodology if it comes out and they surveyed 1,000 people and all of a sudden come out with this what is seemingly influential global report. Whereas Interbrand's, it's deep accounting. It's also attitudinal. There's just a lot of elements to it. So I think it rolls up to being, you know, the seminal brand ranking.
Well, and that's tricky too, because it seems like, I mean, not to minimize any other list or ranking out there, but to a certain extent, anybody can make a list of brands. I'm going to ask you at the end for a brand that's made you smile, which is 100% qualitative, and has no economic weight. But I also think, as people who have focus on brand and branding, I think we are called out a lot for something that requires an economic model behind it, and I'm not sure we always deliver on that. Is that fair?
That absolutely is fair. I think so. And, you know, it's the same thing. So when I was with Interbrand and then moved over to DDB, so I saw the two worlds of brand consulting and then purely traditional advertising. And, you know, my complaint with and continues to be with the advertising industry is it's largely self-awarding. There's so many awards out there, right? From, the huge festival, the Cannes Lions, to, the pencil, to, it just goes on. It's a cottage industry within the industry. And I always gravitated to the Effies, or the Effectiveness Awards, because I'm an old time consultant too from Deloitte and Price Waterhouse, and to me it was ingrained that you needed to quantify your impact, and if you did a case study you couldn't just say and things were better. You know, it really needed to say and how were they better. You know, did sales go up by X, did you reduce costs by Y, and could you you know, quantify customer satisfaction, all those sort of things. So I do believe when we speak brand, it's you know, it can be a subjective thing. There can be a lot of emotion tied to a brand, but that all has to end up in something positive on the balance sheet, something positive in the results.
Well, and you talk about something positive on the balance sheet, something positive in the results, and I feel like a lot of times when called on for that, a mistake is to try to put it together at the end. And I think everything that you just talked about requires more homework on the front end than maybe many are doing as well.
I think that's right. And it's one thing I took away that was really, once again, different in my two worlds of brand consulting to seeing how traditional advertising ran, was when you get that brief, you know, that thing that says this is going to be the project in traditional advertising. And what I learned is the tighter the brief, the better the result, because you didn't want things to be loose between the brand or the client and the advertising agency. You wanted to be really tight. We're out to accomplish these things. Therefore, we can measure our impact at the end of the engagement, the end of the campaign, the end of 18 months, whatever that would be. Whereas in brand consulting, I think it has gotten a little bit better in tightening up, but oftentimes even still, like I do rebrandings, it'll be rebrand me. Well, what's the goal in the rebranding? It's not to have a new logo and tagline. You know, there's got to be something more quantifiable, metric driven, if you're going to be making that big change. Because I can tell you a rebranding doesn't matter the size of a company. It's a jarring event in the, you know, the lifespan of that entity, because it touches everything. And so if you're going to make that disruption and sometimes make a gigantic investment, you know, why do it? What's the payday?
Well, and I think that's a really good point too, because there's some culpability on all sides of the relationship. Because I know as a brand consultant myself, I've had conversations like that. We need, you know, whatever the outputs are, a new logo, a new tagline, a new, you know, brand experience, as opposed to what's the actual goal. And sometimes there can be some absence of thought on the other side of the table as well.
Well, I think that's it. You know, I'm working with, and it's even hard to define them because they're in a really neat space. They're kind of Canada's, I don't want to say it this way, it's terrible. I was about to say they're Canada's version of America's this, and that's a terrible way to describe a brand. But the client is called Beaver Tails, and they have like 140 locations throughout the world, very big in Canada, trying to break into the U.S. They have a fantastic confectionery sweet treat product in the shape of an actual beaver tail, and then it's layered with delicious toppings, and it's sweet and salty at the same time. It's a fantastic product that's really been bought into here in Canada, and now it's a question of raising its profile in other markets. And I'm working with them, and they're tremendous folks. They're marketing driven, they're brand driven, you know, they're service driven, quality driven, that they've got so many things going for them. But I'm working on their brand story. And, you know, so the brief is write a compelling brand story that will work in most markets. Hard to really even put metrics behind that. So there's a degree of trust in this particular engagement between myself as consultant and them as brand and client, that we're going to end up with something that will give them a new platform, a new narrative, how to talk about themselves, and then that will cascade through their marketing. But really, you know, pretty tough to put metrics around this. So interesting enough, some engagements, you just can't get to that.
Yeah, and it is, you know, there's a lot of things that are tricky in that too, of service, of quality, of all of these things that many say, but it can be hard to get specific around some of those at the story level. You know, how do you find something that is unique for a brand that, you know, when you ask some of those intake consulting questions, and you hear things that as you write them down, they sound interesting, but on another pass, how do you tease beyond the surface level for some of those key drivers?
You nailed it. That's and I love being stymied, and I'm quite frankly, yeah. I hope my client's not listening, but I'm stymied a bit right now with them, and it's in a good way, because I think a brand story always should be built upon, you know, those things that we talk about, you know, a good storytelling narrative, act one, act two, act three. How do you want people to feel when they read it? What do you want them to do? What are their takeaways? But I believe a brand story, and I found this a lot more on my B2B clients than necessarily B2C, but tensions in the business. If there's two competing things that sort of make it really tough to express, that's actually a good thing, because I think too often in branding and marketing now, and certainly in, you know, online advertising where it's 5 seconds, quick hits, we're almost afraid at talking and telling a brand's complexity. And it's in the complexity that the story actually exists. You know, in my new book, Why Marketing Works, I kind of draft off David Ogilvy. In his heyday, he said, you know, we're becoming too much entertainers and geniuses in the advertising and marketing business. And our job here is to provide information to allow people to make a better decision. And so I fully subscribe to that. And, you know, you can't do that in 5 seconds, 10 seconds. You can make people aware, but you're not necessarily going to convince them in short form marketing and advertising. So that's why I believe brand stories must be robust narratives full of good stuff.
Are you enjoying this conversation about branding? If so, I'd love to bring my Brand Now keynote speech to your next conference or corporate event. Based on my popular book, Brand Now, this talk breaks down the 7 dynamics of building a standout brand in our crowded, distracted world. Entertaining and educational, your audience will learn, laugh, and leave with ideas they can implement right away. Learn more, including watching video and viewing popular presentation topics at nickwestergaard.com/speaking. That's nickwestergaard with 2 A's .com/speaking. Now back to the show. That is so important, I think, when you noted the role that tension plays, because I think that business, well, in business, story and storytelling are the headlines that everybody's nodding along with, and we're you know, doing a better job of storytelling. But I think that key point, that conflict, we are so hesitant to convey something that we think might upset a client, that might be an odd, sharp edge on our business that we feel like we should sand out. But that tension is so key. And I love that you mentioned the B2B side, because I know we get a lot of questions from B2B listeners who feel so different. And I think that they are blessed with maybe a heightened awareness of that tension, if that's the right way to say it, because it's usually more identified for someone that is selling a very specific widget to a very specific buyer in a very specific industry than it is to someone, you know, selling razor blades.
You know, you hit it, and I'm glad you have the same experience as me with B2B. Or, you know, professional services related, believe it or not, about 60 to 70% of my business, I'm advising consultancies and other agencies. So I'm kind of the consultant to consultants. And I rebranded a business 5 years ago, Merits Canada, the loyalty consulting company with technology behind it too, and can do all the loyalty card stuff, but they're fantastic strategists as well. And I renamed them Bond because of that notion of loyalty, and put a suffix on the name Bond Brand Loyalty, because they were making a real change and they were competing with their American parent in the US and actually ended up doing a management buyout. And now they're their own entity and you know, have clients like Under Armour and you know, really big ones, Ralph Lauren. And actually, what I did in writing the brand narrative and focusing on those conflict or tension points is the CEO said to me, "You have identified the 7 things that keep me up at night." And okay, so that's a nice kudo. Yeah. But then the brand has to tackle those things on behalf of the business. At Interbrand, we were fond of saying brand strategy brings business strategy to life. So in your business strategy, say you have seven tensions like Bond did, well, you can now begin to address them openly, honestly, with all your stakeholders, from your employees to your existing and potential clients, and state them. They're like a theorem. You know, when scientists go to work, they have a ton of assumptions, and because you don't have all the answers. But if you state the assumptions, you address them openly, I think you got a better chance of success.
So talk to me, when you say brand narrative, because again, we talk more and more about storytelling and story components like narrative. If I get a brand narrative from someone like you, what do I have? Is that a roadmap? Is it a story? Is there consistency among what that is?
Yeah, no, it's kind of funny about methodologies, and you know, I've concocted my own and obviously been influenced by the agencies and consultancies I've worked at and for. But when I say a brand narrative, I actually write upwards of a 2,000 word story. Sometimes that story has the same seven things to be answered in it, such as where do we come from? Where is our world going? You know, and your basic one you need to get to, what it is that we have that is different or that we do differently. So those would be three of the seven questions potentially that are framing the story. So some clients like to see that. They don't want to read a fiction novel. They want to read kind of a mini report. But quite frankly, the flow of the words would be almost identical with the exception of those headers being there guiding people. But I'm really jazzed when I have a client that takes that, you know, 1,500 to 2,500 word actual story, and it becomes the foundation for all of their communications. You'll never see it live on their website in its entirety. There, no one's going to put up our story written by Jeff Swiston, external consultant, but they will take a paragraph and blow that out, and that could become the way we work section. They'll steal lines from it to for employee events. They might use a header on an annual report even, and they'll make sure that the narrative is the vein for everything that they say, whether they're speaking at a conference or they're putting out a newsletter. It becomes the touchstone to go back to and make sure that it's got all those things in branding that you need to have, which is differentiation, consistency, relevance, and a bit of stretch. You know, the thing shouldn't be looked upon as an awe-inspiring, you know, Bible that you do not touch. There's got to be a degree of flexibility in running a brand now, but I call it a touchstone, something you go back to when you need to reorient yourselves and remind yourselves of why you're in business and why you're doing what you're doing.
I love that you called out one of the biggest challenges in delivering a brand narrative, and that is that clients are used to something that looks like a business plan instead of a 2,000 word story. And for many, that's kind of a freak out moment of, oh no, what do I do? And talking about really the only difference there is you can change the order and add some of those headings. And I think that's so key.
It is. And, you know, you have to adjust to clients and what they're used to, but you also have to challenge their conventions.
Right.
And I always use the example, like how websites have changed, where everything now, when you land on a lot of home pages of a business's website, it's like a scrolling one pager. Whereas before, you know, we had up on top, you know, about us, who we are, what we do. You know, you had that standard convention, and it's so funny in marketing. We're all about being fresh and different, but it's incredible. I always steal the line from Mark Twain, our business is a furious plagiarism. And it really is, because, you know, no one has a monopoly on great ideas. It's hard to be completely original. I often say today, it's like fingers on a fist. You know, you get five things that are different and work in concert with each other, and then you've got something powerful. It's hard to come up with one thing that is going to, you know, change the day.
Yeah, I love that Mark Twain quote. I love many of so quotable, and I'd forgotten about that one, so I've jotted that down.
You should plagiarize it.
Exactly. I mean, that's why it might beat all of the other quotes. So you talked about capturing in that narrative the world as it is today and where we're going, the directional aspect of things. You talked a bit earlier about your book, Why Marketing Works, and what's the path, I don't know if story of the book is the right way to look at it, yep. But I was kind of compelled to think, what do we come out of that the other side knowing?
Yeah, I love that question, because I think there is a story behind every book themselves. The authors will certainly tell you that, the journey to get it written, the catalyst for why they chose to write it, and, you know, really why they put themselves out there. Writing a book is exposing yourself completely naked to the world in many ways, and through many parts in the process. I always thought I had a book in me, or this particular book in me. It took me a long time to write it. You know, and I probably, like you, probably read, what, hundreds of marketing books, or, you know, just general business books with, geared towards marketing. And, you know, I've gone to more conferences that I could count, spoken at them, but also listened to, you know, I might be on the docket over 2 days, and then I listened to the other 8, 9, 10 presenters. And what was getting me was no one was saying anything new, or they weren't packaging it kind of in a new way. And that the biggest trend in the last 5 years around marketing books was we're all attracted to the shiny new toys. We love, you know, social media is going to save us. AI is going to save us now. Or, you know, it's just going to make lives easier and we're going to get more efficient and effective. And I think technology, actually, back to brand narratives, can rip the emotion and the human nature of things out of a brand. So we have to be very vigilant around that. So I was kind of tired of books that continued to mention, you know, the same top brands. Not that they're not relevant, but I just found it got repetitious. You know, I don't need to hear about Apple all the time, Coke all the time, McDonald's all the time. Though I, you know, I referenced them a little bit in the book. I went out after having a catalyst change. My wife and I went to a local farmer's market, and it was the catalyst for the book. I saw vendors, artisans, deeply invested in their own business, call it their brand, selling with enthusiasm and authenticity to people, but still having to convince them to buy, whether it be, you know, an ornate pie with incredibly, you know, layered pastry on top, or fresh cuts of meat, or beautifully arranged flowers. You know, these people are putting their heart and souls into these business. And I think sometimes when brands get big, they lose that heart and soul. And I was really, really amazed by it. And I'm a big historian. I love history. So my research was to go back as far as I could, find the most obscure marketing stories I can find. I tell the story of After 8 Mints, you know, and I've had reviewers look at the book and go, I've never heard this marketing story before. You Need a Biscuit from Nabisco, you know, the first $1 million ad campaign ever, you know, in the early 1900s, and how it was done so brilliantly by NWA, or an agency that no longer exists. So I went back, combed through history, which doesn't sound revolutionary, but once again, marketers get stuck in the present and get stuck with technology. And I went back and just said, you know, what has worked in the past, and can we extrapolate that to today and into the future? And arrived at 7 principles that, once again, I'll say, aren't earth-shattering unto themselves, but when they work together, I believe they perform exponentially.
I think that's so great to hear. I was just thinking, to your point of, we've all, and probably listeners as well, there's, with all of these shiny new toys, it's yielded all sorts of marketing books that probably most of us have read. I almost thought of rephrasing this question for whenever someone's on with a book, of just saying, why another marketing book? And I think your point about that look back, which you mentioned is so simple. Boy, I'm not sure it is for our people.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And when I look at, you know, I'm got my ego or my pride to see where my book is falling in Amazon rankings. And I, you know, see it's performing well in the areas that it's been linked to, advertising, business communications, of course. And so I'm looking at the books that are clustered around me in terms of selling performance. And some of them are like 14 page more brochures than anything on how to do SEO. And I get it. That's a neat little how-to. It's good, and I understand, but I'm going, you know, I poured my heart and soul into this book, and this thing that's selling for $1.99 is beating me in the Amazon rankings. So I'm beating up on a few things here. I was certainly not disparaging that subject or that author. I may be beating up a little bit on how Amazon does its rankings. But if you look at the top 100 business communication books, you'll be amazed that probably 60 to 70% of them are these quick little how-to manuals. And to me, that's tactics in search of a strategy. Now, maybe the people buying them have a fantastic grasp of strategy and creativity and insights. But really what my book is arguing, if you don't have those fundamentals of marketing, why are you running to a Facebook campaign? Why do you think video would be so important to your business? You just don't know. It seems like you're clutching at straws in execution, whereas if you have a really smart brand strategy and know your audience and know how you want to convey your difference, the other stuff will fall into line.
I'd love to pretend that we planned it, but it almost seems like we've come full circle back to that initial point of why do you want a new logo? Why do you want a new tagline? And not knowing that. And we do the same thing, the same behaviors with, I need a Facebook campaign. I need one of those short, snappy video things that everyone's doing. And the why behind that is something that we need to define. And I think that is why some of those core marketing principles that you say might not be earth-shattering, but boy, I think they're evergreen, and it's... And you can distill it down to a farmer's market booth, to these classic campaigns, to the folks that are executing those campaigns that you're seeing and liking today using Facebook and video. But there's more to it than just grasping at what's shiny.
And you know what? And if I could, because I think you'll get a kick out of this, I am putting out from time to time little snippets around the book because I find them fascinating, and luckily it seems that audiences are too. And I'm doing like little poster one pagers and you know, putting that on my LinkedIn and stuff, because I certainly still want to keep enthusiasm and promotion around the book. But so I just did one around Gillette. Like, I tell the early story of, you know, the gentleman's name was King Camp Gillette, which I think is just a great name. Good for branding purposes right there. But, you know, in 1903, he sold only 51 razors and 168 blades. And it was this cutting edge technology, literally cutting edge technology. And the next year, those 51 razors were actually then 90,884 razors. He went from 168 blades to over 120,000 blades. And what I learned was he didn't buy more advertising space. He didn't put up more billboards or paintings on the wall, because that was kind of the thing back then, or even ads in newspapers and that. He totally repositioned what this tool was about. He really didn't have a purpose except to say, this is, you know, better than a straight razor that you have to sharpen every day like they did back then. So that change in that year's sales is he repositioned this stamped metal blade, interchangeable product that he had invented, as a time saver, as a hygiene helper, and a very cool way to achieve greater professional success. So you see, he actually went for fundamental benefit and kind of emotional and higher order benefit all in one package. And who wouldn't want to see sales go up that high?
I was going to say it's definitely moving up and to the right, and did it by very strategically telling that brand story. I love that example.
That's a great one.
Well, Jeff, as we start to wrap up here, and I love hearing about all of these different brands, these classic stories that we've heard about, like Gillette, and hearing about interesting brands, because you're right, in everyone's reading, we're encountering, and it's hard not to include them. I've certainly done it, Starbucks, Coke, but I love hearing about Beavertail and Bond. But I have to ask you now for a brand that has made you smile recently.
Yeah, and you know, there's been several, but I've really enjoyed what Lacoste has done, in the last little while, well, last year, but they've just put some more oomph into the campaign. And of course, you know, it's got the green crocodile as its, you know, iconic logo that we're all familiar with. And I write about them in the book, too, that they did an amazing thing by coming from France after World War II, trying to, you know, get into the U.S. market. It was very difficult for Americans to get, you know, have any association with this brand. But, you know, through smart marketing and actually celebrity endorsements, everyone from, you know, President Kennedy and Bing Crosby wearing those iconic cardigans, you know, they were able to become a symbol of success in America. And now what I love in their most recent campaign is because they've had this, you know, iconic green crocodile, they've decided to raise awareness about endangered animals, creatures on the planet, and have put out limited edition shirts, which replaces their own brand, which I think is incredibly brave, right? It's because it's such a identifiable mark. And the fervor around this, the positive nature around this, is just fantastic, raising awareness, raising funds, and at the end, the brand benefits because it has that association with doing something right in the world.
I love that. It's a great story and a great help for the world, and those are stories that we love to tell and we love to be a part of. Jeff, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Certainly, yeah. My website is swistoncommunications.com. It's a tough spelling, but I'm it'll show up in how you intro this podcast, so people can go there. swistoncommunications.com. I'm on most social media and would love to connect with people through LinkedIn and Twitter or whatever. I love having conversations about branding and marketing, and meter's never always running with me. If someone wants to have a 15-minute conversation, I just love getting my head around what people are experiencing, opportunities they're trying to capture, and problems they're trying to solve. So I really do encourage people to reach out to me through my site, and I'll be very responsive.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Jeff, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thank you, Nick. It was a pleasure.
And as a reminder, you can find all of those links to what we just talked about at onbrandpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you like to listen. If you like what you're hearing, remember to rate and review the show to help others find it. And for more on me, including how you can sign up for my In Case You Missed It newsletter, please visit nickwestergaard.com. Speaking of spellings, that's Westergaard with two A's. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.